alarm, leading to a shockingly high rate of cesarean sections, 30%, that began to level off only in 2009. No longer could we place all the blame for the mismanagement of childbirth on patriarchy. Women were also up against technocracy, as Davis Floyd writes, and the idea that any procedure involving wires, drugs, and scalpels was inherently superior to anything that proceeded without technological intervention. Even at the height of the women's health movement, we hesitated to extend the feminist critique to those aspects of care that are not specific to women. True, on the academic and New Agey fringes of the movement, there were plenty of women who began to lump together patriarchy, technology, science, and imperialism into a single monolith bent on universal domination. Most of us, though, claimed science for our side, and took it as our mission to restore scientific rationality to a medical enterprise contaminated by sexism. We tended to assume that, aside from women's care, medicine was relatively unbiased and neutral in its social impact. Not so, argued social critic Ivan Illich in his 1975 book Medical Nemesis, which documented the negative effects of medical care on both sexes, in particular the toll of iatrogenic illnesses, that is, those induced by pharmaceuticals and the medical procedures themselves. Furthermore, he stated that medical institutions represent a vast system of social control, ruled by an educated elite. Medicine has the authority to label one man's complaint a legitimate illness, to declare a second man sick though he himself does not complain, and to refuse a third social recognition of his pain, his disability. Like women, men who were not members of the educated elite, poor or working-class men, often faced a hostile and condescending medical profession. In a 1976 article, sociologist Irving K. Zola offered the case of his own father, a blue-collar worker who was advised by his physician to switch to a desk job, as if that were a possibility. Zola, an avid supporter of the women's health movement, saw male as well as female patients being required to enact a ritual of deference to the doctor and the bureaucracy he was embedded in. Whether it be horizontal or in some awkward placement on one's back or stomach, legs splayed or cramped, or even in front of a desk, the patient is placed in a series of passive, dependent, and often humiliating positions. According to critical thinkers like Zola and Illich, one of the functions of medical ritual is social control. Medical encounters occur across what is often a profound gap in social status. Despite the last few decades' surge in immigrant and female doctors, the physician is likely to be an educated and affluent white male, and the interaction requires the patient to exhibit submissive behavior, to undress, for example, and be open to penetration of his or her bodily cavities. These are the same sorts of procedures that are normally undertaken by the criminal justice system, with its compulsive strip searches, and they are not intended to bolster the recipient's self-esteem. Whether consciously or not, the physician and patient are enacting a ritual of domination and submission, much like the kowtowing required in the presence of a Chinese emperor. Some physicians, unsurprisingly, see medical rituals very differently. Instead of defending their procedures as scientific and invoking their personal experience as a form of evidence every bit as worthy as statistics, they defend ritual as the core of the medical encounter. Patients may care about a cure, but they are even more intent on engaging in a ritual. One of the loudest proponents of medical ritual is Stanford medical professor Abraham Verghese, who wrote in a New York Times op-ed that most patients expect certain procedures when the doctor sees them, and they are quick to perceive when he or she gives those procedures short shrift by, say, placing the stethoscope on top of the gown instead of the skin, doing a cursory prod of the belly, and wrapping up in 30 seconds. Rituals are about transformation, the crossing of a threshold, And in the case of the bedside exam, the transformation is the cementing of the doctor-patient relationship. And what is the nature of this relationship? As he expands in a TED Talk, it is a relationship based on the patient's submission to inquiries and physical contact that would normally be seen as rude or, worse, assaultive. Well, I would submit to you that the ritual of one individual coming to another and telling them things that they would not tell their preacher or rabbi, and then, incredibly on top of that, disrobing and allowing touch, I would submit to you that that is a ritual of exceeding importance. This is, to say the least, a muddled proposition. Is the ritual necessary to soften whatever discomfort might be caused by the intimacies required for good medical care? Or is it the other way around, that the intimacies are required to heighten the drama of the ritual? Apparently, the intimacies may in no way be required for successful care, but patients, always unnamed, of course, demand them anyway. Verghese offers an anecdote about a breast cancer patient who had gone for her treatment to what she judged to be the best cancer center in the world, only to return a few months later to the less prestigious facility where she had been diagnosed. He runs into her there and asks, "Why did you come back and get your care here?" And she was reluctant to tell me. She said, "The cancer center was wonderful. It had a beautiful facility. Giant atrium, valet parking, a piano that played itself, a concierge that took you around from here to there. But," she said, "but they did not touch my breasts." Now you and I could argue that they probably did not need to touch her breasts. They had her scanned inside out. They understood her breast cancer at the molecular level. They had no need to touch her breasts. Here, the defense of medical ritual verges creepily on the excuse commonly offered by sexual assailants. She was asking for it. None of which is to say that human interactions, including rituals and touch, play no role in healthcare. Think of the mother's kiss that magically relieves a toddler's boo-boo, or the reassurance that emanates from a concerned and kindly healthcare provider. Our bodies are not cadavers. They are inhabited by our minds, through which we are connected to other humans and animals, both living and dead. Strengthen those connections, and we are likely to feel better. Threaten or sever them, and the result could be fatal, as in cases of voodoo death, widely observed in traditional societies, where a person who has received a death curse or broken a powerful taboo dies within a day or so for no apparent physical reason. There is hard evidence for the efficacy of ritual displays of concern in the form of the well-documented placebo effect. Patients given a sham treatment, say a sugar pill, are more likely to feel better than those given no treatment, real or fake, at all. In one study, those who received a fake treatment along with care described by the experimenter as very schmaltzy, with elaborate expressions of concern, "I'm so glad to meet you. I know how difficult this is for you," while being touched on their hands and shoulders, did better than those who had been given their placebo in a more brusque and impersonal fashion. This result was attributed by some to positive thinking. If you expect that an intervention will help, it probably will. But then the experimenter, Ted Kapchuk of Harvard Medical Services, eliminated the effect of positive expectations. He and his team told a subgroup of patients that what they were being given was in fact a placebo, like a sugar pill. Not only did we make it absolutely clear that these pills had no active ingredient and were made from inert substances, but we actually had placebo printed on the bottle. To the researchers' surprise, the patients who knowingly took the placebo experienced improvements comparable to those who took a real, FDA-approved medicine for their condition, irritable bowel syndrome. These findings, says Kapchuk, suggest that there may be significant benefit to the very performance of medical ritual. Physicians who, like Verghese, emphasize the importance of the medical encounter as a ritualized interaction may take comfort from these placebo studies. From a scientific standpoint, though, they cast yet another awkward light on the epistemology of medicine. The idea, going back at least to the turn of the 20th century, had been that medical procedures were entirely rational, with each step dictated by well-tested biomedical principles. Everyone acknowledged a role for incalculable factors like schmaltz or bedside manner, but this role was thought to be auxiliary to the main event, the surgery, administration of pharmaceuticals, or interventions of scientifically proven value. But if what the patient really needs, at least in some cases, is attention and some display of concern, why is the practice of medicine limited to laboratory-trained physicians operating in massively capital-intensive medical institutions? Well, it could be argued that science, or the veneer of science, is required to make a ritual acceptable to modern educated people, who are unlikely to be impressed by drumming and animal horns. The Ihamba ritual may be the culturally appropriate way for the Ndembu people to express concern for an afflicted person. Westerners require the trappings of big science, imaging machines, centrifuges, and sterile or at least blank interior rooms. But to my knowledge, no one has tested this proposition. Would it help to add cut flowers, soothing music, and friendlier faces to the conventional medical encounter? Does all the equipment have to be real, or would cardboard imitations do just as well? And if the real point of medical ritual is to demonstrate social support for the patient, surely we could do so in ways that are less grotesquely expensive, as well as less stressful and demeaning. Chapter 3. The Veneer of Science. What gives medicine its authority is the presumption that it is based on science. A few centuries ago, the major source of intellectual and moral authority in Western culture was religion, which requires that you put your trust in some distant personage like Jesus or Muhammad, because large numbers of other people who are thought to be trustworthy already do so. Science was a big improvement in that it does not require trust, which rests on social conformity, but offers a way of verifying things for yourself. I know that any scientific claim I encounter, whether about the moons of Jupiter or the best way to treat a fever, can in principle be tested by repeating the observations made by scientists. No belief is required, only patience and the infinite humility it takes to learn daunting forms of mathematics and biology. If the claim cannot be verified by independent observers, if it is, in other words, irreproducible, we are forced to conclude that it is not true. Since most of us are unlikely to learn enough math to calculate the orbits of Jupiter's moons, we tend to defer to those who have, at least in planetary lunar matters. Similarly, modern educated people are usually intimidated by the mere invocation of science. We want remedies that are scientifically proven and can bear up under the phrase, "studies show." So in the medical case, if a person previously unknown to you requested that you undress and submit to his or her probings, you would be unlikely to comply. But if that person could justify their request with decades of experience and peer-reviewed studies showing that this procedure had contributed to the longevity and well-being of large numbers of others, well, then it might be wise to do what is asked of you. The medical profession won its monopoly over the business of healing by invoking its scientific basis, and maintained that monopoly by diligently patrolling its borders against the alternatives, long described as pseudoscience. A little more than a century ago, the matter appeared to be settled when non-physicians were legally barred from practicing, which in the United States meant outlawing midwifery in favor of obstetrics and marginalizing homeopathy in favor of allopathic, aka regular or scientific medicine. Only slowly did any kind of real détente arise, with the AMA-style doctors gradually softening their invective against alternatives. As late as the 1950s, the American Cancer Society, which is about as medically conventional as a health-related group could be, still had a committee on quackery. But according to Harvard Magazine, later that committee turned into a committee on unproven methods of cancer management, superseded by one on questionable methods. The names indicate a gradual acceptance of the unconventional. Today, the Cancer Society has a Committee on Complementary and Alternative Medicine, CAM. The evolving vocabulary also reflects a sea change underway throughout medicine. In the last few years, the term alternative, suggesting something done instead of conventional medicine, has been giving way to complementary, a therapy done along with mainstream treatment. Both words may ultimately be replaced by integrative medicine, the use of techniques like acupuncture, massage, herbal treatments, and meditation in regular medical practice. This may look like commendable humility on the part of conventional medicine, or it may look like a shameless compromise. But how scientific is conventional scientific medicine anyway? By the late 20th century, mathematically oriented physicians, as well as many patients, were beginning to ask for something more than a doctor's word for the efficacy of medical interventions, and something more tangible than the mere aura of science. They wanted hard evidence, and one familiar procedure after another has come up short. In 1974, a former physician-turned-mathematician, David M. Eddy, was asked to give a talk on medical decision-making and chose to focus on diagnostic mammography since Betty Ford's and Happy Rockefeller's breast cancers were very much in the news at the time. Years later, he wrote that he had planned to write out the decision tree I presumed their physicians had used, fully expecting to find strong evidence, good numbers, and sound reasoning that I could describe to my audience. But to my amazement, I found very few numbers, no formal rationale, and blatant errors in reasoning. How could that be? He decided to try to study the decision-making behind something that had been around much longer than mammography, a 75-year-old treatment for ocular hypertension that had been used on tens of millions of people. But he could only find 8 controlled studies, meaning studies comparing people who had received the treatment to a group of similar people who had not, and these studies were all very small and poorly designed. Worse, 6 of them found that the recipients of treatment ended up worse off than those who had not received it. Eddie moved on to analyze other treatments, only to be warned off by experts who told him there was not enough data to work on. That clinched it. If there wasn't sufficient information to develop a decision tree, what in the world were physicians basing their decisions on? I then realized that medical decision-making was not built on a bedrock of evidence or formal analysis, but was standing on jello. So began what was soon called evidence-based medicine, the idea that anything performed on patients should be backed up by statistical evidence. This was a provocative designation, raising the immediate question of what medicine had been based on up until now. Anecdotes, habits, hunches? Or was medicine traditionally not evidence-based, but eminence-based? That is, backed by the reputations and institutional standing of the people who practiced it. Most of the medical screenings that have been pressed on me by one health professional or another fail the evidence-based test. Mammograms, for example. The conventional wisdom, tirelessly repeated by the leading breast cancer advocacy group, the Susan G. Komen Foundation, was that early detection through annual mammography would significantly increase the 5-year survival rate from breast cancer. But repeated, huge, often international studies showed no significant decline in breast cancer mortality that could be attributed to routine mammographic screening. True, Any woman whose cancer had been detected through screening might claim to have been saved by the intervention, but the likelihood was that the spot in her mammogram would never have developed into full-blown cancer. What screening was finding, and doctors were treating, were often slow-growing or inactive tumor sites, or even non-invasive conditions like the wrongly named ductal cancer in situ, or DCIS. Treating precancers and non-cancers may seem like a commendable excess of caution, except that the treatments themselves, surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, entail their own considerable risks. Disturbingly enough, breast biopsies are themselves a risk factor for cancer and can seed adjacent tissue with cancer cells. The same kinds of concerns apply to screening for prostate cancer, which consists of a blood test for prostate-specific antigen, PSA, plus a digital rectal exam. As with mammography, statistical studies have found no overall decrease in mortality that can be attributed to the PSA screening that has been in place since the late 1980s. Here, too, the price can be high for overdiagnosis and treatment. Radiation and hormonal therapies that can lead to incontinence, impotence, and cardiovascular disease. In 2011, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended that men no longer receive PSA tests, and 2 years later, the American Urological Association grudgingly followed suit, limiting PSA screening to men between the ages of 55 and 69. As for colonoscopies, they may detect potentially cancerous polyps, but they are excessively costly in the United States, up to $10,000, and have been found to be no more accurate than much cheaper non-invasive tests, such as examination of the feces for traces of blood. There is an inherent problem with cancer screening. It has been based on the assumption that a tumor is like a living creature, growing from small to large, and at the same time from innocent to malignant. Hence the emphasis on staging tumors from 0 to 4 based on their size and whether there is evidence of any metastasis throughout the body. As it turns out, though, size is not a reliable indicator of the threat level. A small tumor may be highly aggressive, just as a large one may be indolent, meaning that a lot of people are being treated for tumors that will likely never pose any problem. One recent study found that almost half the men over 66 being treated for prostate cancer are unlikely to live long enough to get the disease anyway. They will, however, live long enough to suffer from the adverse consequences of their treatment. The physical part of the annual physical is largely determined by the individual physician and, of course, the insurance company or other institution underwriting the exam. According to the Canadian Task Force on Preventive Healthcare, it consisted of a head-to-toe physical examination and the use of whatever tests were available: blood count, urine glucose and protein, chest X-ray, and since the 1950s, ECG, CT scans, and MRIs. And I would add an emphasis on whatever. In the 1940s and 50s, when there were more U.S. hospital beds than could be filled by the injured or ill, affluent patients could expect to be hospitalized for their annual exams, the better to anesthetize them for invasive procedures. At the other end of the class spectrum, more or less, pre-induction medical exams for the military were notably sketchy, usually consisting of a hearing and vision test, plus a quick inspection for hemorrhoids and open lesions. In between these extremes, most people had their vital signs taken, their urine and blood worked up, their breasts or testicles palpated, perhaps with a digital rectal exam thrown in. In 2015, the cost of annual physicals was estimated at $10 billion a year. Women are supposed to undergo a second gynecological annual exam, and this one has been well defined since its inception in the 1950s. Breast and external genitalia exams, a pap smear to detect cervical cancer, a vaginal and perhaps rectal exam. These exams are not always voluntarily undertaken. They may be required as a condition of obtaining or renewing a prescription for a contraceptive. Recall the searing scene in Mad Men, where Peggy undergoes a gyne exam in order to get birth control pills, and the male doctor cautions her that just because the pills are expensive, she shouldn't become the town pump just to get her money's worth. Many women are traumatized by these exams, which in their detailed attention to breasts and genitalia so closely mimic actual sexual encounters. Out-of-place intimacies, like unwelcome touching by a male co-worker, are normally regarded as sexual harassment, but the entire gyne exam consists of intimate touching, however disguised as a professional, scientifically justified procedure. And sometimes this can be a pretty thin disguise. A physician attached to an American missionary compound in Bangladesh is alleged to have molested girls, one as young as 12, by subjecting them to almost daily breast and pelvic exams, procedures that are not normally performed on preteen girls. Even under the best, most professional circumstances, such exams can be deeply upsetting. According to one woman, writing on a site called For Women's Eyes Only, pelvic exams are humiliating, degrading, and painful. The first time I had a pap smear done, I was so traumatized, I now have to take prescription Xanax to avoid having panic attacks when I get pap smears done now. And I'm only 24. How many more am I going to have for the rest of my life? What am I going to do when I want to have children, and every doctor wants to shove his, her fingers and tools inside me? Other women strive for a state of psychological dissociation, attempting to share the physician's view of their body as a passive and unfeeling object, detached from a conscious mind. One problem, though certainly not the only problem, with these regularly scheduled invasions of privacy is that they do not save lives or reduce the risk of illness. In 2014, the American College of Physicians announced that standard gyne exams were of no value for asymptomatic adult women and were certainly not worth the discomfort, anxiety, pain, and additional medical costs they entailed. As for the annual physical exams offered to both sexes, their evidentiary foundations had begun to crumble over 40 years ago, to the point where a physician in 2015 could write that they were basically worthless. Both types of exams can lead to false positives, followed by unnecessary tests and even surgery, or to a false sense of reassurance, since a condition that was undetectable at the time of the exam could blossom into a potentially fatal cancer within a few months. But such considerations do not seem to have deterred many physicians, like this one, quoted in a New York Times article entitled, "Annual Physical Checkup May Be an Empty Ritual." Dr. Baron Lerner, an internist and historian of medicine at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons, says he asks patients to come in every year and always listens to their heart and lungs, does a rectal exam, checks lymph nodes, palpates their abdomens, and examines the breasts of his female patients. "It's what I was taught, and it's what patients have been taught to expect," he said, although he acknowledged he would be hard-pressed to give a scientific justification for those procedures. None of this should be construed as an attack on the notion of scientific medicine. True, the medical profession has again and again misused the authority conferred on it by science to justify unnecessary procedures for the sake of profits or simply to gratify physicians' egos, and in the worst case, sexual impulses. But medicine's alliance with science has also brought incalculable benefits, from sterile technique in the operating room to life-saving pharmaceuticals. The only cure for bad science is more science, which has to include both statistical analysis and some recognition that the patient is not just a statistic, but a conscious, intelligent agent, just as the doctor is. There remains a considerable market for comprehensive exams filled with tests and procedures that are no longer recommended, just as there is a luxury market for antique cars and vinyl records. I first encountered this phenomenon in the 1990s, when a wealthy acquaintance, unprompted by any symptoms, took off for a 2-day-long medical exam at Johns Hopkins. Other, perhaps even wealthier people opt for multi-day exams combined with spa services and lifestyle coaching in luxury vacation settings. As of 2008, 22% of Fortune 500 companies provided executive exams to their top personnel, both as a perk and as a way to avoid having a trusted leader die of a heart attack at his or her desk. But an article in the Harvard Business Review entitled "Executive Physicals, What's the ROI, Return on Investment?" answers its own question with what amounts to a firm, not much, and for all the reasons I have given here. The frequency of false positives, the dangers of the tests themselves, such as radiation, and the unlikelihood of finding a problem in a still treatable stage. Mounting insistence on evidence-based medicine, some of it coming from the health insurance industry, led, in the early 21st century, to the perception that medicine was going through an epistemological crisis, that is, a crisis in its intellectual foundations. In 2006, the noted bioethicist Arthur L. Kaplan wrote, "Contemporary medicine is sailing on very rocky seas these days. It is being buffeted by ever-rising costs, doubts about its efficacy, and intrusions on its turf from competitors that range from optometrists, psychologists, chiropractors, midwives, and nurse anesthetists to the friendly folks at the herb and vitamin store." But, he went on, it was the fervency of the embrace of evidence-based medicine that struck at the profession's core conceit, the notion that it was derived, at least since the late 19th century, from the arduous methods and processes of the hard sciences. Laboratories and cadavers. In fact, the relationship between medicine and science has always been tenuous. 150 years ago, there was no American medical profession, only a collection of diverse men and women claiming healing skills, some with years of experience, but many with little more than an apprenticeship to go on. Only toward the end of the 19th century did it become fashionable for relatively elite college-educated doctors to round off their educations in Germany. There they were entranced by the university's gleaming new medical research labs, with their microscopes, test tubes, and well-scrubbed countertops, which had no analog in the United States. Laboratories are forbidding places to the uninitiated, showing few signs of human occupation except for the occasional stool and making no concessions to decoration. But to a scientist, they represent a place where he, and at one time it was almost always he, potentially exercised total control, with no disruptive breezes or temperature changes, and hopefully no contaminants. It was the white coat of the laboratory scientist, the chemist, or the bacteriologist that physicians eventually adopted as a uniform suitable for encounters with patients. What it symbolizes is not only cleanliness, but mastery and control. In a laboratory, the causes of disease could be traced to the cellular level and studied like any other natural phenomenon, hence the proclamation of the famed German researcher Rudolf Virchow that medical practice is nothing but a minor offshoot of pathological physiology as developed in laboratories of animal experimentation. This is, of course, an arguable proposition, but it immediately provided legitimation for a wave of professional reform in the United States. Medicine was the business of scientists, or at least of the scientifically trained, and no one should be legally certified to practice it without at least 2 years, now 4, of college education and a thorough background in the laboratory sciences. But the relevance of the scientific reforms in medical education to the actual practice of medicine remains unclear. For example, no one attains the right to practice medicine without studying organic chemistry in college. a course that pre-med students call the weed-out course, since it eliminates so many aspirants to the medical profession. But organic chemistry, delightful as it may be from my point of view, has no obvious contribution to make to medicine. A comprehension of electron orbitals is not required for an understanding of the germ theory of disease, nor do you need to appreciate the structure of DNA to study genetic disorders. An obstetrician complained. The Krebs cycle is a classic example, a biochemical cycle where you have to learn all these enzymes, and when you get through, you never use it. My sister in med school now tells me the same thing. She can't understand why she is going through all these detailed analyses of DNA structures and things like that. But one likely effect of the scientific reform of medicine was to scare away any critical social scientists. Except for tongue-in-cheek offerings like body rituals among the Nacarema, none of the anthropologists and sociologists who took up the study of medical care in the mid to late 20th century dared to question the relative efficacy of primitive rituals and those of modern scientific medicine. They seem to have assumed that medical procedures, being based on scientific observations and methods, must be of proven value, even when those procedures look suspiciously like rituals. After all, the social sciences also considered themselves to be sciences, and were habitually deferential to the medical profession, with its formidable armor of biochemistry and microbiology. No mere social scientist was prepared to weigh in on the question of whether particular medical procedures actually did any good. Predictably enough, the medical reforms of the early 20th century narrowed the demographic base of the medical profession. The requirement that medical schools possess laboratories eliminated most schools that had admitted women and African Americans. Furthermore, at a time when only 5% of the population had a college degree, the requirement of at least some college limited medical school admissions to the upper and upper middle classes. No longer could any crude boy or jaded clerk, as one of the leading reformers described the run-of-the-mill doctors of his time, expect to gain medical training. Doctors would be recruited from the class of gentlemen, which was why even female patients could now entrust them with intimate access to their bodies. For most people, throughout most of the 20th century, medical care necessarily involved an encounter with a social superior, a white male from a relatively privileged background. With medicine anchored, at least symbolically, in laboratory science, the practice of medicine changed too. Medicine began to look like an extractive industry, as health policy expert Rob Berlig once put it, with the doctor's office serving as a collection site where blood, urine, and bits of tissue were converted into laboratory samples and hence into data. Or it might be images, like X-rays or CT scans that are harvested, sometimes sent out for analysis, possibly to a distant country where radiologists are paid less. As the focus shifted to tissues and cells, physicians began to seem impatient with the intact human body. They wanted, and according to their training, needed, to reach inside, past the skin, to whatever pathologies lay within. Melvin Connor, an anthropologist turned medical student, described his first experience with surgery. "My fingers had been inside another person's body, not just in the mouth or vagina or rectum, but beneath the protective surface of the skin, the inviolable film set up by millions of years of evolution, the envelope of ultimate individuality. For me, it had been an unforgettable experience." In the laboratory-centered environment, the patient's words, his or her medical history and reported symptoms, count for less than the objective data that instruments can collect. Recall my difficulty in convincing an internist that I could breathe perfectly well, despite the evidence from his brand new device. At another time in my life, I had the opposite problem, trying to convince a doctor that my cardiac symptoms were real, not psychosomatic. The problem was eventually diagnosed as non-life-threatening and treatable with a beta blocker. When you visit a doctor for the first time, you may be asked to show up half an hour early to give you time to fill out a lengthy history, but many of the questions will be asked again anyway, suggesting that your efforts went unread. Or they may be ignored. Thomas Duncan, the first person to die of Ebola in the United States, told an emergency room nurse that he had just arrived from Liberia, one of the epicenters of the epidemic, but that information never reached the attending physician, who sent Duncan home with instructions to take Tylenol. It could be argued that the ideal patient says nothing, lies perfectly still, and makes no objection to the most invasive procedures. In fact, the first patient a medical student usually encounters is dead, a cadaver donated for dissection. And death is a condition that, as philosopher Jeffrey P. Bishop points out, is almost a prerequisite for scientific study. After all, life is in flux, and it is difficult to make truth claims about matter in motion, about bodies in flux. The heart is beating, blood is flowing, cells are metabolizing and even rushing about the living tissue. Thus life is no foundation upon which to build a true science of medicine, he continues. This may sound like calculated irony, but consider how a true science, like biology, actually works. Until very recent advances in microscopy, the study of life at the microscopic level required that you first kill a laboratory animal, remove the tissue you want to study, slice a bit of it very thin, then fix it by rendering it thoroughly dead, in fact embalmed, with formaldehyde. Only then is it ready to go on the glass slide that you will see through the microscope, although what you see will be only a distant approximation of living tissue within a living animal, just as a field strewn with dead bodies will give you little idea of the issues that led to war. Similarly, Bishop proposes that the dead body is epistemologically normative in medicine, since what goes on in living bodies is too blurry, ever-changing, and confusing for study. Many physicians and social scientists have questioned the pedagogical value of cadaver dissection. After all, the cadaver is dead and artificially preserved. It is smelly, leathery, and utterly lacking in the flux that constitutes life. Some prestigious medical schools have abandoned it altogether, instead teaching anatomy on plastic prosections of body parts. But for the most part, American medical schools, though not Italian ones, still insist on cadaver dissection, going so far as to defend it as a rite of passage, in which even the trauma that some medical students experience can be justified as a vital part of their transformation from initiate into full-fledged physician. Medical schools often attempt to humanize the process with little rituals of gratitude to the cadaver's donors, but dissection remains a violent and transgressive undertaking. As one bioethicist observes, one of the functions of anatomy lab is to help teach physicians how to violate social norms that operate in every other social situation, a skill that will be necessary in clinical practice. The detachment that allows student physicians to cut up the dead may help practicing clinicians to put their hands and medical instruments in patients' various bodily orifices, or to ask patients to confess their most shameful secrets and expose their nakedness in the most vulnerable positions. Every profession requires a certain degree of detachment on the part of its practitioners. But in the case of medicine, this affect may mask something darker. Connor, the anthropologist who became a medical student, observes that the stress of clinical training alienates the doctor from the patient, that in a real sense the patient becomes the enemy. The doctors in training, invariably exhausted, blow off steam by talking trash about their patients, who are, of course, the immediate cause of their woes. Patients blow their IVs, as Connor mentions, or spike sudden fevers. Then, too, the rushed pace of modern clinical practice, in which outpatients may be scheduled 10 or 15 minutes apart, contributes to the kind of resentment a retail worker feels in the face of a customer overload. The doctor's detachment is not a defense against excessive empathy, but a downright negative emotional stance, Connor suggests. To cut and puncture a person, to take his or her life in your hands, to pound the chest until the ribs break, these and a thousand other things may require something stronger than objectivity. They may actually require a measure of dislike. So it is ironic that it is the patient, the thinking, feeling, conscious patient, so long discounted or ignored, whom the medical profession has turned to as an ally against the threat of evidence-based medicine. When the epidemiologist points out the uselessness of a certain procedure, the physician counters that this is what his or her patients want and even demand. An internist in Burlington, North Carolina, reports that when he told a 72-year-old patient that she did not need many of the tests she was expecting in her annual physical, she wrote a letter to the local paper complaining about him as an example of socialized medicine. What patients want, according to the foes of evidence-based medicine, is above all a highly stylized but human interaction with a doctor. As one physician argues, medicine's theatrical trappings, the operating theaters, the costumes such as the doctor's white coat and the patient's Johnny gown, the formalized lines and gestures, all contribute to an aesthetic ritual which gives emotional meaning to doctor-patient contact that transcends the notion of a cure. There are arguments that can be made against an over-reliance on statistical evidence, that, for example, it may obscure a patient's unique constellation of problems. As the popular doctor-writer Jerome Groopman puts it, statistics cannot substitute for the human being before you. Statistics embody averages, not individuals. Another argument often deployed against evidence-based medicine is that it can become a tool of the insurance industry to limit the care that will be reimbursed. We should always err on the side of excessive care, medical liberals insist, rather than promoting a potentially dangerous austerity. So there are reasonable arguments against the uncritical adoption of evidence-based medicine, but the notion that it undermines an interaction that transcends the notion of a cure is not one of them. Chapter 4. Crushing the Body. If I seem to be rather cavalier about preventive medical care, it is in part because there are so many alternative pathways to health on offer in our thriving consumer culture. The very word alternative has acquired a certain zing, as in alternative lifestyles, and especially alternative medicine. Consider the disorienting multitude of options, all seemingly compatible and equally respectable, facing anyone seeking help for even the most routine problem, like lower back pain, which almost everyone suffers from at some point in their lives. A conventionally minded person might start with a referral to an orthopedist, who will usually make an effort to localize the problem, in particular vertebrae that can, at least in some cases, be corrected surgically. Or, advised by a friend or a magazine article, the patient might begin with an alternative healer such as a massage therapist or acupuncturist. Often these choices are available in the same setting, perhaps a major university hospital, like that at the University of Maryland Center for Integrative Medicine, where the menu includes reflexology, Reiki, yoga, acupuncture, and micronutrient infusions, as well as physician care. Stanford Center for Integrative Medicine, which offers, among other things, classes in mindfulness and positive psychology, the pursuit of happiness, provides each patient with a 3-member team representing both conventional and alternative medicine to guide them through the many possible treatment options. There are, however, No warning signs to alert the patient that these options have long represented warring sides. On the one side, science, and on the other, any number of ancient, often religious, traditions. Nor is there any clue that one's choice of treatment modalities is anything more than a matter of personal taste. I had my own alternative. Not alternative medicine, but an alternative to medicine. I had begun to work out, to systematically use my body in what could be described as fairly useless ways that had nothing to do with house cleaning or getting myself from one place to another. Early in the 1980s, a friend got me going with her to an unchallenging women's-only gym in a nearby shopping center. She wanted to lose weight. My lower back aches had forced me to realize I could no longer treat my body as mere scaffolding for keeping my head upright. It needed some work. And I needed some play. Except for brief bursts of housework, adult life, it turned out in my case, was conducted in the sitting position, in meetings, or at a desk. The gym offered an enticing regressiveness, a chance, I wrote at the time, to reclaim the lost muscular license of youth. We waved our arms, crunched our abs, or lay on the floor and raised our legs to the beat of Billy Idol's version of Money Money. After a day spent manipulating words and trying to coax paragraphs into an orderly sequence, 45 minutes of zoned-out, militaristic obedience to the fitness instructor in front of the class seemed almost like freedom. At first, I was mortified by the feebleness of my body. But if I wasn't strong, I was at least possessed of a high tolerance for pain, so the mortification began to develop into a secret competitiveness. In normal life, I like to think I am a modest and cooperative person. In the gym, I was always covertly comparing myself to others and seething with ambition to outdo them. Soon I graduated from the women's-only gym to a large, lavishly equipped gym for both sexes, where I began with group classes, staying in the back of the room, where I could observe without being observed, and then worked my way up to the weight room, where the men worked out. All of this was completely removed from my normal professional and personal life, and not even worth mentioning to anyone, I thought. Too trivial and narcissistic. The first affirmation I got for all this effort was from a male friend who warned me that my upper arms were getting scary. There is no single satisfying historical explanation for the surge of interest in physical fitness that hit the United States in the late 20th century and spread from there to other affluent parts of the world. One factor was simply the growing availability of fitness-inducing experiences, such as those offered by gyms. In the 1970s, the few gyms that existed tended to be no-frills weight rooms, not all of them even with showers. Today, there are 186,000 health clubs worldwide, generating about $81 billion a year, of which about $26 billion is spent in the United States, with Germany and Brazil not far behind. Sometime in the 1980s, entrepreneurs discovered that after the initial investment in equipment, it did not take much effort to maintain a gym, only sufficient staff to keep the towels laundered and check clients' membership status when they enter the facility. But the demand as well as the supply was increasing. In some ways, it was part of a larger withdrawal into individual concerns after the briefly thrilling communal uplift some had experienced in the 1960s. Self-help books proliferated to the point where they became a separate literary genre, as if a fashionable segment of the society had taken up a new project, themselves. Pop psych self-help books advised one to treat relationships as market transactions, always asking whether you're getting as much as you're giving. And if that wasn't working, you could always be your own best friend. To historian Christopher Lash, the fitness obsession was just another aspect of the culture of narcissism, representing a retreat from politics and a repudiation of the recent past. Lash offered Jerry, don't trust anyone over 30, Reuben, as an irrefutable exemplar of this retreat. Reuben had a sterling resume as a radical activist, a flamboyant anti-war leader, a defendant in the Chicago 7 trial for inciting the riots at the 1968 Democratic Convention, a founder, with Abby Hoffman, of the anarchist Yippie movement. In 1969, he was telling college students that America's only choices were catastrophe and decadence or revolution and a new lifestyle. But in his case, it was the new lifestyle that won out over the revolution. As the 1970s went on, he sampled every available New Age fad. Est, Rolfing, yoga, meditation. Finally emerging as a proud capitalist entrepreneur and promoter of physical fitness. He saw himself not as a sellout, but as a role model for personal growth. But there is a case to be made for Lash's theory that the new self-involvement represented by fitness was in fact a kind of defeat. When the movement petered out, Reuben's erstwhile comrade Abby Hoffman did not transform himself into a self-improvement guru or businessman. He committed suicide. Of course, most of the young, educated people who started jogging and gym-going in the 1970s and 80s had never expected, much less worked to bring about, a political and cultural revolution. But they had hoped for stable employment, preferably in jobs they found meaningful and creative, and in an age when the entire sociological map was being redrawn, there was little chance of that. First, the traditional blue-collar working class gave way to deindustrialization, meaning plant closings and layoffs. As the downsizing fervor spread to the nonprofit sector, whole sections of the professional middle class crumbled off like calves from a melting iceberg. Human service agencies began to shed their social workers, psychologists, and public interest lawyers. Universities shuttered departments like philosophy and foreign languages that were failing to generate sufficient revenue. An alarming new phenomenon appeared. The taxi-driving PhD, predecessor of today's avatar of educational disutility, the PhD on food stamps. In the face of so much class turmoil, young people rapidly rolled back their expectations to fit the narrowing career possibilities. UCLA's annual survey of undergraduate attitudes found a sharp decline in altruism and social concerns, with a record 73% in 1987 reporting that their top goal was being very well off financially, compared with 39% in 1970. I met them all the time on campuses, students who had started out with an interest in social work or environmentalism, deciding regretfully to settle for majors in business or economics. But there was not much security even for the most practical-minded, because in the 1980s, corporations also began to downsize, or right-size, their white-collar workforces. GE was routinely culling out its bottom 15% of performers decades before Amazon got the idea. There were no more jobs for life, no automatic promotions leading to a gold watch at retirement. Business gurus advised corporate employees to stop worrying about who stole their cheese and focus instead on surfing the chaos. But if you could not change the world or even chart your own career, you could still control your own body, what goes into it, and how muscular energy is expended. Fitness pioneer Jim Fix wrote in The Complete Book of Running, "Having lost faith in much of society, government, business, marriage, the church, and so on, we seem to have turned to